A podcast of the cinema. And if you're joining us for the first time, you're Dave White, and I'm Alonzo Duralde. We both write for The Wrap, and I do What the Flick on the Young Turks Network on YouTube.
When you say we both write for The Wrap, what you really mean is I write two movie reviews a month at The Wrap-ish.
Yes.
And you're the film reviews editor, and you write reviews every dang week, and
yes.
You're my boss.
Yeah, well,
that's what you're really
saying. That's a stretch.
Let's be fully clear.
Fine. Anyway,
with what's going on?
We're both film critics, and we're married to each other. You can also catch me on What the Flick on the Young Turks Network on YouTube. Be nice to the boss.
Boss in the wrap room.
There we go.
Make dinner for the editor. Hey,
there's a third voice here.
To write reviews.
Yes, it's amazing how that works.
Yeah.
We're so delighted to have back to the program. He's visited us several times, talking about everything from Star Wars to The Fifth Estate, and his digressions are great.
And other hits.
And we're always glad to have him. Jack Morrissey is here.
Hello.
Hooray!
You are a co-executive or co-producer?
Co-producer.
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 On Beauty and the Beast.
But let's not lead with that.
Sorry.
Did you stay through the credits?
I did. And I saw his name.
Watch your remember
yeah.
things.
Then. I'm in the stack of the short stack of co-producers.
That's like four. That's
stacked
like...
stacked to please the one. Eye with the longest four. Name Alexander Young being at the bottom.
So. There are some movies out there where like the producer cards get staggering, you know.
Yeah.
First, we just wanted to say we're so sorry that all the anti-gay boycotts of the film have been so successful that nobody is seeing this movie this weekend, that it pulled in a mere $350 million worldwide. So,
I know
you're all weeping about that.
It's as R.O. from the Twilight Saga universe would say, it's a sadness.
Now we are, as you all know,
yes,
this is a film review show.
Correct.
However,
with two critics from The Wrap,
we are not reviewing
new
Beauty and the Beast.
Recused.
We have recused ourselves from this task.
Because and don't we know it?
Because we must.
We know.
It was true. No, I was even going through my like roster of LA writers. I was like, I turned to Robert. He's like, no, I can't do it because Robert wrote the big companion Twilight book. Robert Abley, yes.
Yeah.
So he knows you guys, and it's sort of like, you know, I think this is your sort of stealth mission. Is if you can befriend enough film critics, it takes us off the board.
It's hilarious. I was just
there
talking
really
about this with the director
wall.
Last night. How quaint your ethics. How very quaint.
Someone needs that.
Look, it's all about ethics
especially
and film criticism.
Especially in the online world.
There should be
most,
a giant wall
many
between.
Many people have no idea what the word recusal means. And
no,
I'm not...
Yeah.
Seriously.
No, I believe it. Yeah. And it's... I feel weird about it. And there was a time where I could feel like I could review this stuff and just sort of have a disclaimer. Oh, by the way, I know this person. And then finally, like,
Linoleum can't. Knife Podcast is a division of the Walt Disney Company.
Hardly.
There have been moments when I worked for movies.com.
Yeah.
Where I had no choice but to review things.
Yeah, like were, like Dean DeBlois films.
Like The Dragon, How to Train Your Dragon, but like the last two Twilights. Like
There's no one else to throw it to.
Yeah.
We just had Del Shores on. You had to review Sorted Lives.
Each time I had to put it in print, for the record, first sentence. Yes.
I have carnal knowledge.
Sexually involved with...
I had a torrid triad with the Condon Morrisseys
exactly.
In the Bahamas.
The it's you know, it was always this thing, like, I know one of these actors, this person is a friend, you know. And so, like I was saying, there should be a giant wall separating where we get to live and where y'all get to live. And that way we never know each other.
Well, that was Pauline Kael's
Certain
thing.
Folks in politics are working on that.
Yeah, indeed. Build it.
They're working very hard on that.
No, Pauline Kael always said that there would be no great film criticism comes out of Los Angeles because inexorably critics who live in L.A. get subsumed into the system. Yes. Mind you, this is a woman who then went to work for Warren Beatty for a while. So, course. You know, what does she know?
No, yeah, there's just, I mean, it is, we've said this so many times, it's inevitable that you become acquainted with people.
Sure.
And there's no getting
and some
around
of them
it.
You actually like.
Yeah.
And you have to.
You get on with.
Yeah, and you have to figure out how you're gonna navigate your, you know, critical
path.
Job.
Yeah. We're not so different, you and I. No, I mean, I think a lot of times you do get to know filmmakers or writers or whatever, and they grew up nerding out over the same stuff you
That's
did.
That's the thing. After you,
they just
after you
pursued
spend,
it in a different way, you know.
After you spend the first 10 minutes in life having met Bill Condon talking about nothing but sweet charity, it's hard then to ... you know?
Well, that's actually a good segue because I wanted to talk about how, obviously, you know, musicals are right up in his wheelhouse. Mm-hmm. You know, he wrote Chicago, he wrote and directed Dreamgirls on film. He just did Sideshow on Broadway.
Yeah.
You know, this is totally his stuff. Was it kind of an inevitable thing then that when, you know, this movie was being mounted as a musical, as, you know, technically the film of the stage version of the cartoon, you know,
right.
He's one of the few people right now who is a go-to, you know, it's not like it's, you know, the MGM Freed unit where there's a million people running around who know how to do this sort of movie.
Sure. He said this sufficiently in print that I feel like I can say this and not get my hand slapped. But the reality is, 3 years ago, when he first got the call from David Hoberman, who was the producer on the former studio boss at Disney, who's now so-called indie prod on the Disney lot with Mandeville Films, when David Hoberman's office first called Bill to gauge Bill's potential interest in a live-action version of Beauty and the Beast. The moment Bill told me about that, I was like, and the answer is yes. Something I hadn't said since the Breaking Dawn inquiry come in. And his reply was, really, I'm not so sure. You know? And the next day, he got on the phone with David Hoberman, and he found out what they'd been developing for a couple of years at that point, which was basically a Snow White and the Huntsman style movie.
Hmm.
Gaston was a real war hero, I think from the War of Austrian Secession. And it was pretty straightforward and not particularly musical.
Huh.
And they had decided in the wake of the unexpected success of Frozen, which the studio hadn't really seen coming,
right.
They decided that maybe they should add some of the songs from the 1991 animated classic Beauty and the Beast into this live-action version. So they would add certainly the title song, I think, certainly Be Our Guest, and the third one was either the opening song Belle or Gaston. But that was the idea. It was basically a straightforward, Bill referred to it, Peter Jackson Tolkien knockoff, which was sort of, a lot of that was happening at the time, with three songs grafted onto it. That was the idea that they offered him.
So and, like Jungle Book, where they're like, okay, we have to acknowledge that people think of this as a musical, but we're just going to...
I think a different situation there, because my suspicion, and one of your listeners who's done their homework might correct, my suspicion is that Jon Favreau really drove that train. It's I think Jon Favreau, based on his childhood obsession with the animated Jungle Book, went to them and said, hey, I'd really like to do. That was not the case here. The case here was that the call was an incoming, and then they sort of told Bill what they were thinking, and Bill passed. That's the reality.
Okay.
And David Hoberman, said, whoa, 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 what would you do? And Bill said, well, I would just literally, I would take the 1991 animated movie with that incredible Alan Menken score.
Mm-hmm.
I would look at the Disney's Beauty and the Beast Broadway musical, which is one of the 10 longest running musicals in Broadway history.
Wow.
I would look at that musical to see if there was anything from that iteration. And I would just do a live action version of that score of that. I would do Beauty and the Beast as a live action movie musical.
Right.
And they took to that and that, and all of that stuff that had been in development for 2 years was very quickly, those drafts, script drafts, et cetera, were now moot.
And was it Schabowski and...
Schabowski, no, it was just Evan Spilotopoulos, I think, had been doing writing on that concept. And he had also, he wrote on, I think, The Huntsman.
Yes.
Winter's War. And I can't remember whether he was on that job before or after or during Beauty and the Beast. But Stephen Schabowski, author, novelist, screenwriter, director of most notably Perks of Being a Wallflower, was brought on after Bill came on.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, because I was, that makes a lot of sense because it, this version, if you're looking at it amongst the Disney live action versions, kind of stands out in its
musicality.
Well, that, but also I think just sort of its fidelity to the original. I mean, Cinderella comes close, but they throw in a few new angles. You know,
and if you loved any of the songs in the original animated Cinderella, you may have been disappointed not to have any sort of experience of those songs.
Right.
Same for Jungle Book. I have no real... My knowledge of Jungle Book is pretty limited. I did go see the Jon Favreau film. I thought it was really spectacular and incredible, but... Yeah. I couldn't tell you how many I know certainly watched, as did anyone who saw that movie, his version of Bare Necessities, but I don't know how many other songs make it in. Four? Is it six? Is it two? I don't know.
I mean, there's something.
Do you?
There's something that slipped in really quickly, like, you know, the Snake has that song, that Trust in Me song.
Well,
that is
Scarlett Johansson sings that over the closing credits.
Yes.
That's right, which is sort of a little cheating, right?
And there's a long...
It's in the movie, technically.
Right. There's a longer version of I Want to Be Like You over the closing credits, although they put a little of it in the movie.
Right.
I couldn't sit down and name them all off, but I knew there was stuff missing or there was stuff that was kind of woven in real quickly and then, you know, out
again. I think that anytime Disney makes one of these animated... classics, some of them classics for prior generations, which are represented in rides in Fantasyland,
right.
Mostly, right? and now they're moving into these more modern classics that are sort of generational touchstones, the Menken-Ashman, Menken-Rice, Beauty and the Beast, The Little Mermaid,
Aladdin,
The Lion King. Yeah. Every time they... one of the things I remember that Sean Bailey, who runs... Walt Disney Pictures, said to Bill early on, is every time they take one of these animated movies and even start to contemplate whether or not they're going to take them into the live-action realm, they really look at each movie as its own animal, and what should the live-action version of each of these things be or not be? Then, obviously, they select and take meetings and determine availability, interest, etc., with a filmmaker. The filmmaker comes on board, and then the real conversation begins in terms of what the filmmaker's interest is in certainly involving any original, highly caffeinated, any original movie that involves any kind of songbook. What's the filmmaker's level of interest, and how many of those songs they would like to see in the live action film.
Right.
What's the studio's level of interest? And now the conversation really starts in earnest. Bill was always super clear that he felt all of the songs from the 1991 animated classic would be in, every single one of them.
Sure.
And that as they got into the process of figuring out what enhancements or further connections they would make in the new movie. Belle's backstory, for instance, a bit of the Beast's childhood story. If there was any new song, if there was the need for any new musical material, that it should be Alan Menken writing it, with ideally Tim Rice, who is the only lyricist beyond Howard Ashman to ever have worked on this in another iteration, obviously having written the lyrics for the new songs in the Broadway musical version.
Right.
Fortunately, he goes to Alan Menken. That's his first call, which I admire greatly. This is the director of a movie musical, calls immediately the composer of the source material and says, Alan, would you be interested? Alan, hugely interested and very enthusiastic about that. And but I think that as regards Jungle Book, I think it comes down to Jon Favreau's interest and how many of those songs and which songs, and a dialogue with the studio on same. And I think moving forward now, it will be interesting because as they, you know, we've seen on Twitter this weekend that I think the director of Nicky Caro.
Yes, who's doing Mulan.
Who's doing the live action Mulan has announced, I think, I've only read the sort of the headline of the tweet, not the body, that there will be no songs in the live action Mulan. How does the Disney fandom feel about not having songs in a live action version? I don't know. There aren't enough minutes in the day. But how many songs will there be in Jon Favreau's Lion King? How many songs will there be in Guy Ritchie's Aladdin? How many songs will there be in the Little Mermaid version that Lin-Manuel Miranda has come aboard now to help producer Mark Platt figure out? They don't have a director involved yet.
Hasn't Dumbo been floating around the conversation?
Tim Burton is directing a live-action Dumbo.
Yikes.
I presume there were songs in the original animated version, right? I can't even remember.
You can
fly as Peter Pan.
You can fly. Well, the Pink Elephants on Parade, Baby, You're Mine.
Right.
Those are the two that leap to mind. I'm sure there's some other ones.
Yeah.
There's like some circus song, right? Like with the train.
Maybe.
Anyway.
I think I saw that movie once. Peter Pan, I know better.
Mm-hmm.
David Lowry, who did the live-action Pete's Dragon for Disney last summer, is developing Peter Pan. And the interesting thing to my mind about Peter Pan, which is a childhood obsession of mine, is when you go on that ride in Fantasyland at Disneyland, which Walt designed and built and lived to see the opening of, when you go on that ride, as you know, not quite to the level of It's a Small World insanity-inducing repetition of the song, but it is, you can fly, 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 over and over again. And the lines in Fantasyland are always, always consistently the longest for Peter Pan's flight.
It's true.
So, having had a chance to talk to David Lowry, I said to him, it's like, what are you going to do with You Can Fly? Again, this is that animated movie is of a different generation.
Right.
So his reply to that could be, well, I don't know that we're really going to do it beyond something over, say, the closing credits, and the villagers won't show up at his windmill with torches and pitchforks. Right. But if Jon Favreau made the announcement next week on Twitter, Lion King will not be a musical, we're just going to do it straight, I would lock the gates, you know?
Well, I mean, you know, I mean, but the music is just sort of one aspect of what people are playing with. I mean, like, this Beauty and the Beast is very straightforward, and I think, but it's very true to the storyline.
Yes.
As opposed to something like Maleficent, which is...
is wicked.
Right, ish. Yeah. I mean, or
Wicked plus Ms. VFX 45. Plus,
but just like that's totally taking this other tack, you know. And so that it's interesting.
But by the way, the studio is developing a live action Sleeping Beauty.
Oh, in addition to really okay, interesting.
Yeah, that's announced.
Oh, all right. I don't.
I'm not leaking secrets.
No. I don't dig that deep into the upcoming. You know.
And I think Maleficent 2 is also, I think Angelina Jolie's made a few statements in the press within the last few months that she's sort of, looking forward to getting back to work on, playing that character again.
So you have been living with B&B for three years.
Okay. Yeah, it's crazy.
And, you know, I mean, just maybe walk us a little through that process in terms of the big decisions of, you know, is it going to be somebody in a clock costume or is it going to be, you know, mocap? Is it going to be...
Yeah, in early days after, you know, you go through the courtship with the studio and then finally the offer arrives.
Right.
And once the offer arrives, then the negotiation begins. And once you be... And the negotiation... And all through it, obviously, you can't just suspend creative work.
Sure.
But... In very early days, my fellow co-producer and the guy who really sort of helps to run everything around Bill, the sort of Kathy Kennedy, if you will, of Bill's life, is Greg Yolen. Greg Yolen and I and my friend Adam Cook, who introduced Bill and I to each other, as a matter of fact, we literally just started pulling reference material, running, you know, very broad Google searches for search terms like people trapped in furniture, cursed objects, enchanted clock, or for instance, cursed forest, dark castle,
right?
That sort of thing. You're obviously, you go straight to Coppola's Bram Stoker's Dracula, right?
Yeah. Cocteau's version?
Was absolutely.
That?
Yeah, a hugely expensive coffee table book that just has like 500 images from the Cocteau.
Wow.
Acquired immediately and was on Bill's coffee table in his apartment in London for the entirety of the...
Post-it sticking out the side.
Yes. No, literally. I've got a... There's a photograph of that next to the original... sort of, you know, super deluxe coffee table book based on the 1991 Disney film, which is called Tale as Old as Time, which they've just issued an expanded edition of, etc. Those two, the Cocteau book, the Cocteau coffee table book, and the original edition of Tale as Old as Time, which is, at the time I had to buy it, was for some wacky price on Amazon because it was so long out of print, right? Were just side by side on the table with, pads and pads of post-it notes sticking out of them, yeah.
So then after the research process and once the...
You start to settle into... Then they go out to VFX vendors. And I think you start looking at proof of concept ideas.
Right.
As to how these, in this case, the Cursed Castle staff might be realized. Production designers hired Sarah Greenwood, who's done a ton of stuff for... Director Joe Wright, and you start getting, you know, an art department starts to rise, and you start getting into just really abstract concept work and studies, and the conversation just happens every day after every day after every day as to how to figure all this stuff out, you know?
Is it tricky to deal with, and this is something that's been sort of happening since probably the 60s, you know, like the end of the sort of the big movie musical, like
That's
the big
right.
studio movie musical.
Yeah, filmed on back lots with built sets and super old-fashioned.
But the notion of, you know, there used to be, you know, you would have your stable of your Gene Kellys and your Howard Keels and your, you know, whoever. And now there's this thing of like, there are, you know, people who can definitely sing, like most of whom come from the stage. And then you've got like big names and then sort of finding the Venn diagram in the middle of like who can open this movie in you know, Singapore
around the
and
world.
Also yeah exactly
in our global movie going culture
exactly but can also belt like was that you know, how did that all play out?
Well, I mean, it's a huge cast, obviously.
Sure.
It's a huge, very diverse cast, so every conversation, if you want to have the conversation as to, for instance, how Stanley Tucci came aboard to play this new character of a, you know, a cursed harpsichord versus Emma Watson as Belle, those are two different conversations, right? And again, the cast, from the heroes to the villains into all the entirety of the castle staff, it's a very long cast. So that's a tough question to answer.
Sure, no, I understand.
In a general term. Emma Watson, which is probably who most people are interested in. The interesting thing with Emma Watson is, as soon as Bill came aboard, or from the minute the first phone call arrived, I'm on the internet, Greg is on the internet, and we're reading up, we're collecting information and data, and you know that she is involved in some way, shape, or form with a live-action Beauty and the Beast project at Warner Brothers that Guillermo del Toro is directing.
Huh.
And she's asked about that consistently anytime she's on Harry Potter, red carpets, etc., by outlets like MTV News. Yeah. So everybody, if you Google Emma Watson, Beauty and the Beast, Del Toro, MTV, you'll see, you'll get so many returns, right? So the truth of it is, which takes a while to discover, well, like what's going on, because obviously these studios are sort of like walled, competing walled cities. It's hard to get information. And the large agencies do nothing but try to pull information out and, sure, and give you the information. The reality is that, as I am led to believe, which itself may not, all these years later, may not be fully correct, but what I am led to believe is that she at some point, she either went to Warner Brothers or Warner Brothers came to her and said, hey, what about a live-action Beauty and the Beast movie? They had already were running a successful Beauty and the Beast TV series on the CW.
Right. And they're doing another Jungle Book, right?
They're doing a competing Jungle Book directed by Andy Serkis, which is now somewhere in post-production.
Gotcha.
Right? Yeah. And I don't even know, I couldn't even tell you what the current release date of the Serkis Jungle Book is. I know, like Guy Ritchie's King Arthur movie, also at Warner Brothers, that release date has moved and moved and moved again.
Gotcha.
So part of Bill's, I think part of a concern early on was, well, first of all, Bill coming aboard a live-action Beauty and the Beast movie at Disney, how does this affect Guillermo del Toro's live-action Beauty and the Beast movie at Warner Brothers? And that's Emma Watson's involved with that. And very quick, it's not rocket science that Emma Watson at this point, coming off of 8 Harry Potter movies or whatever it is. Is it 8? Not my fandom.
At least 7.
It's many, many.
I know there's 2 from the last book, so that's what's throwing me. But yeah.
So the interest in Emma Watson to play Belle in any version of Beauty and the Beast, is it's a no-brainer.
Sure.
Right? It turns out, I think Warner Brothers went to her. She went to Warner. They started a sort of development process, which is neither here nor there. She ended up meeting and talking with Del Toro at a certain point, and she got Del Toro interested in that idea of a live-action Beauty and the Beast. Some might argue that he'd already made it with Pan's Labyrinth.
Mm, yeah, true.
He came aboard one of many projects that he had in development, including, by the way, the Haunted Mansion at Disney, all around town. But it was, she involved him. And then, if memory serves, there was sort of a early days back channel conversation. Would she be interested in any other version of? Hmm. What if Disney was actually going to take the version that she grew up on, as did so many, and do a live action version of that? How would she feel? All that stuff. And somewhere right around that time, Del Toro fell off it, as he does, right? And she came on board, and the sort of the rest is history, you know?
And had she sung before? I mean, had she trained at all?
No, to my knowledge, she'd never done any real singing as a kid.
Hmm.
She has to test. Hmm. So she goes away. She and Bill have a meeting. It's great, out of the box. And then she goes away and works with a vocal coach. And it's the question sort of becomes, what is her start point? How quickly can she develop?
Mm-hmm.
And where can she get to, right? And then the test comes in and everybody listens to the test. And it's sort of not dissimilar from the Jennifer Hudson process on Dreamgirls. It's like, yeah, there's definitely something here, you know, there's something there that wasn't there before. And enough to work with. And let's keep working, you know? Yeah. So The hilarious thing I have to say is you read around comments from the first minute that a little bit of Emma's singing voice is revealed through a doll over the holidays. Right? There's a doll that goes onto shelves at Toys R Us prematurely in violation of the street date for the merchandise and so forth. And suddenly everyone is listening to Emma Watson's singing voice coming out of a shitty, you know, speaker on a plastic doll. And they're recording that with their iPhone camera and uploading that iPhone recording onto the internet, etc. Yeah. Right from the first minute, people start going auto-tune. And the funny thing is, my joke is, if instead of Beauty and the Beast opening in theaters this week, it was actually Dreamgirls,
yeah,
with Jennifer Hudson, same performance, same movie, everything,
right,
you'd have people in comment threads on social media saying, ugh, Jennifer right. Hudson, I mean, I want to like it, but she's just so auto-tuned.
Right.
You know? Why do, what is that impulse for people to suggest that, and again, auto-tuning like a home, cheapy home software thing that anybody can buy, what is the impulse for these armchair quarterbacks to all suggest that Emma Watson is auto-tuned, but nobody really suggests that Josh, you don't read that the men are auto-tuned.
Right.
No one lobs that right. snowball yeah. at men. Right. No one lobs it at Audra McDonald. And the folks who are, it's like most of them don't know any better.
Yeah, I mean, you know? Like, yeah, okay, fine. Ewan McGregor saying in Moulin Rouge and Josh Gad and you know, Luke Evans have been on stage. But like nobody says it about Dan Stevens, and he's not known for
no,
his.
No, I actually, I have to say, it's like I read a review. I'm trying to think who it was. Who she's casting aspersions at Dan Stevens' singing voice, and you just want to go like, what do you actually have to do? And by the way, it's like, we have the footage. It's already been used in sort of advanced promotional kind of little featurettes that might show on, you know, Disney Channel or something. Right. You can see Emma Watson singing in the recording booth, and then you cut to Alan Menken, the composer,
right.
Bill Condon, who knows a thing or two about movie musicals, and like six or seven other pros all arrayed on the other side of the glass
right.
with their dials and levers and so forth, all listening to her singing. She's obviously having a good time. Alan Menken literally does a thumbs up, but that's not good enough for you because I guess what, we've gotten involved with that material and we've tracked in that fake. It's like, come on. Well, that, come on. We have footage of everyone singing.
Yeah, of course.
You know?
Yeah.
And it will all be on the Blu-ray at a very attractive
the internet
price at Target.
Loves to ferret out a lie even when there isn't one
mm-hmm.
to dig into.
Yeah.
Everybody loves a conspiracy.
Yeah.
Especially if they get to be in on the ground floor.
And they get to be an expert.
Yes.
Yeah.
The as someone who went to the Grove and bought a ticket Friday morning at 9 a.m.
Yeah.
I had the place basically to myself, by the way, which was perfect.
Right.
Not for you, but for me.
It turned out all right. I'm thrilled you had the experience
yeah,
you did.
My God, I love being alone. You know, it's 9 o'clock in the morning. The singing is solid throughout.
Yeah.
Everybody.
Yeah.
Everybody.
Totally. Yeah.
And so
and a deathless score. Like I was reminding him, like, God, every song in this thing is so great.
Yeah.
And I think also when you deal with, I think Broadway audiences and certainly like opera fans are used to the idea of, here's this score and every couple of years I'm going to hear somebody else take a crack at it.
That's right.
There's going to be a revival and you know, so I was like, this time it's going to be Bernadette Peters. This time it's going to be Patti LuPone, you know. And so
Bill was just going off on this.
And so the idea that this movie, because it was a movie, it's sacrosanct and set in stone. It's like, no, it's these songs live and they breathe through new people, you know.
I honestly think before Bill had to start figuring out, it's not like when you get a phone call from the Walt Disney Company or the producer who they've assigned the project to saying, would you be interested in, you don't sit there and you don't go, God, why would I want to make this movie? Let's think of various and sundry reasons why I would want to make this movie. And is there someone available to take dictation so 3 years from now I can list all the reasons very attractively and beautifully presented? You don't have those sorts of conversations, but it's clear the reason you make that move. Why would you make any Why would any director worth his salt make any movie musical? The answer must be the score.
Sure.
His reason, and literally as we were walking down Hollywood Boulevard, through some twists and turns of conversation, he happened to say to me the other night, something that he'd never really said it to me before, even back in the early days, but it's like, well, let me give this just a little more context.
Okay.
We went to the El Capitan, which Disney owns.
Right.
Where this is, I'm thrilled through all the coffee haze to remember to say this, especially for your listenership, particularly for anyone who lives in or near LA. They are showing an overture at the El Capitan.
Yes, I saw that at the premiere.
It's the only theater you can see this at.
Oh, okay. Right?
It is spectacular. Oh. Visuals by a company called Prologue, whose Kyle Cooper's company did all the credits, most famously for David Fincher's Seven.
Oh, right? Wow, okay.
They also did our curtain call at the end of this movie, as they did the curtain call at the end of Breaking Dawn Part 2. They're showing an overture, and also downstairs, they have a gallery of set decoration, props, and costumes that even by Disney standards is unbelievably spectacular.
Hmm.
This is Disney's El Capitan Theater on Hollywood Boulevard. So we go and we watch a little of the movie there. We see the overture there. I think this was an opening night. But then we go across the street to Grauman's Chinese Theater, which is now owned by an outfit called TCL.
Yeah.
But most importantly, TCL has gotten into business with IMAX, and IMAX has gone in and dug out a section of the front of that theater and installed and has turned Grauman's Chinese Theater, the most famous movie theater in the world, into their Los Angeles, probably West Coast flagship IMAX location, which features, not at every show, they alternate the shows, but at certain shows, not only does it feature 3D, it features their proprietary laser 3D, right? The show we saw was a 2D show. Sitting through that, the title number, the ballroom waltz, Beauty and the Beast, and looking at every shot of the Beast, every shot of the Beast's blue jacket, every shot of obviously that yellow dress, coming out of that theater and then walking down to meet some friends at Musso and Frank, I said to Bill, it's like, can you imagine having to come down and watch that movie? Because I love it, obviously. Watch that movie having been directed by somebody else. And he said, honestly, I remember thinking at the time, part of the reason that you decide to take this on, which does, much like producing the Academy Awards show or taking on the final Twilight novel, it does put a big target on your back. Obviously, which is something that he does take risks. The risks tend not to be too obvious, other than producing the Oscar show, which is an obvious, almost no-win scenario. Yeah. But he does take risks, and he does usually doesn't question taking those risks until the reviews start coming in, and then he's wringing his hands like anybody else would over the results of that. But part of the reason he said yes was the score. Part of the reason he said yes is he just didn't want... It is the score. And he didn't want to watch somebody else get to make a live-action version of that score.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, it's a perfect fit, I think. And just, it's a pleasure to watch. I had kind of joked. I mean, obviously, there's been all the kerfuffle about the very subtle and smart and... You know, not in any way offensive gay material.
Are we spoilerific? Should we be spoilerific or not?
I think it's
opening weekend.
It's been. We won't get. We'll
how quickly is this online?
Who doesn't know how it ends?
It's been discussed a lot. So I won't get into the mechanics of it. But what I was going to say was, and I jokingly said this on Twitter. I said I think the gay thing is to distract everyone from the fact that there are two interracial couples in this movie.
Yeah.
Which is I think probably also a first for a Disney film.
Apparently not a first.
Okay.
We thought it was a first. But apparently not a first.
Okay.
And I can't tell you what the firsts are. Yes, there are two interracial brief kisses.
Yeah.
But not history-making in the way that the the so-called exclusively gay moment was.
Right. Which it's a step forward, but I think it's a step forward that is not... We have this discussion all the time. It's like, you know what, parents, you can explain gay to your 8-year-old without having to talk about anal. You have to say is like two boys fall in love, so. Two girls fall in love. That's it. But the way people treat this, whenever you hear the, oh my God, what do I tell my children argument? Yeah. It's like, well, that's what you tell them.
But here's the thing. I sit in a slightly different place than you guys do on it. My thing is you certainly, knowing the movie as I do and watching the movie develop over the course of 3 years as I have, you don't really want... The reality is, if you're not paying attention, you may very likely not even
catch any
see
of it. Yeah, that's true.
And that doesn't mean, by the way, that it's a... that it's an encoded message from Satan that, you know, that we've slipped by you.
Right.
It just means that it's not, you don't, I think parents who have issue, who have questions, that's legitimate. I get it. If I was a parent, I may very well be in the same position. You don't want someone freaked out over whether or not they should bring their kid to a PG-rated movie.
Of course.
By the way, what's that say about the rating system, right?
Yeah.
What I would tell you that I think is of interest about that thing is that, which is 3 seconds of dancing, right? No kissing, no nothing. It's 3 seconds of dancing.
Yeah.
Or less than 3 seconds of dancing. In a very large dance number that involves many, many dancers, it's 3 seconds of dancing. As the New York Times put it when they were covering the Malaysia thing this week, it's like Malaysian censors obsessed over 3 seconds of... not even intimate dancing, right?
Yeah. There's more man-on-man dancing and Fiddler on the Roof, frankly.
Yeah. I first became aware of the potential significance of it when I read... Obviously, we were well underway. I was aware that there was a little dance moment between two male characters. But I... read on Twitter, I think certainly last year, and is it last fall, the sort of blogosphere, not so much critics, I don't think, but it's mostly kind of so-called junket press, etc. People start to get very, wait, we hear there's a, is there a lesbian couple in, is it Finding Dory?
Yes.
Is there a lesbian couple in Finding Dory? Wait, are there two women together in Finding Dory? And then everybody goes to the junket screenings are the first screenings, and people come back onto Twitter and are like, no, nothing moving, no, they never commit to it.
Two women, one stroller. That's as
close
as
they get. Two women,
one
stroller, no. But at that point, that gave me the knowledge for the first time of like, oh, wait a second. So this has never happened in a Walt Disney movie. Other than, as many would argue, coded Disney villains, et cetera, right?
As somebody said, please, Jafar, come
exactly.
on.
Exactly. Or Scar.
Or Scar, yeah.
Right? Right. Or some might say Captain Hook, right?
Sure.
Cyril Richard.
Well, yeah.
Anyway.
He likes a lacy cuff.
Exactly. So I mentioned it to Bill a while later. Were you aware that this is potentially, and again, it's not like I took an hour and drilled down into Disney history or anything like that. But I said, by the way, this thing is happening on Twitter as regards Finding Dory. Turns out not to be. Are you aware? He's like, oh, no, really? There was nothing political about it. It was just in a movie called Beauty and the Beast where the title characters are certainly the most prominent of many romantic couplings in that movie.
Right.
Amongst the cursed castle staff. Why not have amongst those many, many romantic couplings in a very large
ensemble cast,
but also a big, big dance number.
Sure, yeah.
In the so-called royal celebration that ends the movie. Why not just ... It was literally that kind of innocent on his part. He didn't know. He had no idea. And by the way, one pointed out to him, he didn't then go like, well, thank you know. Well, I'm so proud to have. It's like, oh no, really? Oh, great. You know? Yeah. And then, and by the way, I don't think anybody at the, you know, you take the movie through a process of testing, which is you're in front of randomly selected, you know, potential customers or consumers who have enjoyed Disney movies in the past or movies like Disney movies in the past. And you take it through many, many test screenings out in Thousand Oaks at the Movie Co. where they like to go, or in Woodland Hills at the AMC where they like to go. And then you pass out the cards at the end of the research tests. And then a group of 25 or 30 folks are asked to stay behind. Show of hands, what are your top five favorite moments of the movie? What'd you like most about this movie? Put your hands up. Everyone, just don't be shy. Just tell us what you... It never came up.
Interesting.
Never came up. And the studio sort of...
was not having an issue.
No. Yeah. Because at no point did any of these test audiences, which then, again, become smaller focus groups, which are very, very, very diverse.
Yeah.
And largely... There are middle class folks, there are working class folks, there are upper middle class folks. I'm sure there's a gay person or two who randomly gets in there, ethnically very mixed. Nobody. In fact, a few people sort of did say, well, I love that moment.
Well,
enough that there was never any discussion whatsoever about... should we really think about this? Never.
Well, I think the internet has unfortunately put even entertainment news into the 24/7 CNN
Absolutely.
Trap of like, we have to talk about something. You know?
And how.
But yeah, I don't see it as having legs. I'm glad you reminded me about the Oscar thing, because I'm just as somebody who had kind of a front row seat to that. Yes, I want to know
yeah.
what
did you have a literal front row seat? Were you in the Dolby?
Oh no, we were at home on the sofa.
Okay,
but you,
just the two of you, or did you have folks over?
We had some folks over.
Had a couple friends over.
As you do.
Yeah, and it got Zapruder real fast.
Oh my God!
As somebody who, since you've been there, you've been close,
yeah.
and seen the inner workings of it. Like,
yeah.
what was going through your mind when that craziness went down?
I think again, it's sort of some of these things. You sort of want to, and this is my pitch to you guys. Some of these things, it's like, you know, if you have me back in 3 months, I'll tell you a little more.
okay.
But what I would tell you now is, Bill had an interest. First of all, yes, Bill, as anybody who really pays attention to any of this stuff, Bill produced with Lawrence Mark, who produced Dreamgirls, the 81st Academy Awards hosted by Hugh Jackman.
Right.
And what makes this special for Bill and a interesting feather in his hat is that when he was 10 years old, which would have been, so sorry, 1965, he was obsessed with the Academy Awards. He was obsessed with Oscar history, and then he goes on to meet at Columbia University Damian Bona, who with Mason Wiley both departed. Right inside Oscar, which for many, many years is considered the authoritative, before there were so many such books, this
sure.
was Inside Oscar was considered the authoritative guide to the history of the Academy Awards, why certain races went the way it did, what happened at the show, and then this happened, all that kind of stuff. So
Inside Oscar 2, by the way, which goes
Inside
up
Oscar
pretty,
as
like,
well.
to like, what, like the 2000, 2001 or something?
Yeah.
Yeah, great books.
So, and Damian actually came out and worked on the show the year that Bill produced it. Anyway, Bill is a hardcore...
Oscarologist.
Oscar obsessive. Yeah, just really, really, really enjoys that show. The really unique pleasures of that show, which as he's put it, is an award show celebrating movies that takes place in a theater that then is therefore live performance that is broadcast on television. I mean, there's really sort of nothing else like it. His take, he watched it in a hotel room in Disneyland, Shanghai.
Whoa.
With Dan Stevens, who plays the Beast, Luke Evans, who plays Gaston, Josh Gad, who plays LeFou. I think that was the three in the room. They were all watching it. I know Dan Stevens said goodnight after La La Land won because he felt like he'd seen it and left. right?
And a lot of people did that.
Had to be told the next morning what had happened. Yeah. So Bill's interesting take, having watched that moment now many hundreds of times, is that his take is that Warren Beatty opens the envelope. Mm-hmm. First of all, should he have read that the outside of the envelope said best? No, that is not his job. His job,
and
he's already been there.
Too, it was really hard to even look at.
Yes. He's already been there three times probably for full dress rehearsals. There are two of them on Saturday where they run the show, literally only pausing for the exact length of time that each commercial break will take the following day. Mm-hmm. They run two full dress rehearsals on Saturday, one during the day, one in the evening. And then on Sunday morning, they run a third full dress rehearsal, right?
But
Warren Beatty has done this now three times.
You know that one of the dress rehearsals got canceled because the
set
collapsed.
Is that so?
I saw pictures on the internet.
Wow.
Yeah, the set fell apart. So I think one of the dress rehearsals, at least one, didn't happen.
But let's just say Mr. Beatty has already had executed this moment. And by the way, there are friends of the producers, there are many folks, you know, technicians, artisans, makeup, hair people who are all sitting, filling those seats in the orchestra at the Dolby Theater, looking up at you. So it's not like you're opening a fake envelope during the dress rehearsal in front of an empty auditorium. You're looking at a generally, I would say, half full orchestra.
Okay.
Right? So he opens the envelope on air. It's not his job to look at the outside of the envelope. That is not his job.
Of course.
He's handed the envelope. He walks the envelope out. He stops at his mark. He has to pay attention to his co-presenter, in this case, his former leading lady. And he opens the envelope, and Bill's take is he sees immediately, and as we see, he starts to look around, as you say, Zapruder style, he starts to look around. He knows immediately what's happened. But he's such a boss of show business. He's such a war horse. He's been around for so long that even though he sees, obviously, that the winner is Emma Stone, once again, for La La Land, for the second time that evening. He knows it's wrong, but he believes it's probably right. That the winner, either way, is La La Land. Chances are, it's going to be La La Land. No one is ever going to really know that they're holding the wrong envelope, because La La Land is winning Best Picture. He reads. He pays attention to race, the Guild of various and sundry Guild Awards, the Golden Globe Awards, etc. And so he hands it to her, just to have her say what he believes is true, which is that La La Land has won Best Picture.
Hmm.
He believes it's all going to be fine, no matter what, because it's La La Land.
Right, right.
And then it turns out not to be. And that's what makes it, to my mind, the unique pileup is, and I think great for that show, by the way.
Oh, yeah. Everyone's going to tune in next year.
In what, 89 years? These were the 89th?
I think so, yeah.
In 89 years, obviously not all 89 broadcast around the world.
Right.
But in 89 years of a show that really boils down to the molecular DNA of, we get together in a room, from the Blossom Ballroom at the Hollywood Roosevelt across the street to now the Dolby Theater.
Right.
We get together in a room. We open envelopes. The introduction of television cameras. The introduction of sound, obviously. We get together in a room. We open envelopes. What could go wrong? It's the best thing. It gets right to the heart of that show.
Right.
And not just, by the way, what if this had happened for Best Makeup, or Best Costume, or Best Short Documentary film made for less than $1.5 million. right? But the fact that the wrong envelope is opened
at the big
for Best
climax.
Picture, in a way, it's Spielbergian. It's the mothership coming over Devil's Tower. It's perfect. It's perfect.
Oh, and it's,
and it, anything in a, can happen for a change.
Yeah, in a movie, you'd never believe it.
Never.
Ever.
For Moonlight?
Yeah.
Right.
By the way, right? Moonlight wins Best. Still, when you take a step back and look at it, it's like, wow, Moonlight. Yeah. Right. Which I did see, by the way.
Good for you. A low-budget black gay film whose director cites Wong Kar-wai and Claire Denis as influences. Yeah. I was shocked.
It's so insane.
My favorite film of the year never, ever wins Best Picture.
So was that your favorite film?
It was my favorite film of the year.
How great is that?
And so it's like my jinx is lifted now.
And you know what they say? Not. It's like...
You're still a jinx.
Yeah, probably.
They say, when you get close to... a release date of a movie, of course you start to pay attention to, well, how's it going for Kong Skull Island? How's it going for Logan, et cetera? The thing that you hear, you know, one of the old sort of tropes of show business is don't be afraid of your competition or don't be afraid of things that are opening a week or two before you, because if they're good or people enjoy them, which obviously, and some would say about Beauty and the Beast, some of our detractors would say, the two ideas are not connected, right? But movies are movies.
Yeah.
If people go to Logan, Get Out, Skull Island, and have a good time, they're more likely to want to come back to a movie theater
and give
another movie a try, because the last time they went to the theme park, as it were, they had a good ride.
Sure.
Right? So are you Alonzo, more likely... Less likely? Show of hands. Are you more likely, less likely, or about the same to watch the Academy Awards all the way through to Best Picture next year? You're more likely because there's a big breath of fresh, but also just a breath of fresh air that's blown in unexpectedly now through the front doors of, wow, even on the Academy Awards, and thank God it wasn't. The Anything Can Happen isn't like a suicide vest going off and people are killed or something. Anything Can Happen. The wrong envelope after 89 years of what we do best, what we really do better, and we do it better than the Golden Globes, we do it better than the Grammys, we do it better than the Emmys, we open envelopes better than anybody else. Not this year, Blanche. You know? It's amazing. It's life, right?
It's true. No, it's a reminder life. That it's live TV.
Life finds
TV.
A way.
Totally. But it's live TV.
And that's chaos theory.
Yeah, this is true.
To continue our
bring in Jeff Goldblum.
Jumping back just one second, the one thing I want to say about the thing, the best tweet... that I read on the gay thing, which I actually like photographed so I would get it right, was from Washington Post columnist Alexandra Petri. Mm. Do you know her?
I don't.
She tweeted, and my friend Caitlin Parker retweeted, simply this, right in the heat of that shit all going off, right? New York's hottest gay club is... exclusively gay moment. just the best.
Did you get the time on that one?
On his second swears.
Are we profanity free?
Oh yeah, yeah.
I didn't know that.
But he just bleeps you out after.
Oh good.
I caught the first one. I don't know what the second one
just happened.
Oh okay. Yeah. Well, I'll mark it now.
Make it
reminded me at the top of the.
Oh well, you know we don't like to filter you, Jack.
Yeah.
We want full frontal Morrissey.
For the last 3 years, it's been, you know, working with and in a way for the Walt Disney Company. So I'm used to, you won't find profanity in my tweets for the most part.
And let's talk about your social media presence, because you are very connected to the fan base, going at least as far back as Twilight.
Twilight. No, actually, it goes 10 years back to... the message boards now gone forever, right? The message boards recently deleted.
Oh, from IMDb,
Where I was the guy, the sort of the face, or certainly, you know, the screen name, the handle representing the filmmakers on Dreamgirls.
Wow, okay.
And I got a bunch of our Dreamgirls super fans 10 years ago into early regional screenings of that movie all across the country. Just literally believing even them with, you know, that was I think a $75 million movie, and David Geffen, who produced that movie or got that sort of, you know, had that movie up and running at DreamWorks and Paramount, saw to it that the marketing budget was going to be more than adequate for that movie. But I still believe in every single fan.
Sure. Well, and that's, I think, I think studios are sort of constantly trying to figure out how to make social media work and how to, like, get the chatter going. And so, I mean, what's your experience been as far as being that guy who's there to answer questions and there to sort of...
Well, it's been a wild ride. It's been a wild ride on this one, I have to say. There's always a moment where where you're like, oh my God, am I in hot water here with the studio? Because I just inadvertently stepped into a puddle of, you know, there were two or three moments of that on Breaking Dawn 1 and 2 with Summit.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been a moment or two of that on Beauty and the Beast as well. I'll give you an example. Going back to the aforementioned Belle singing doll.
Right.
Right. I'm in New York with Bill for the holidays. You wake up in the morning, you reach for that phone, you go on Instagram, Facebook, etc., and you see what's happening. And, well, there it is. You know, these dolls are on shelves ahead of Street Date, and some fan has found the doll, recorded the doll's singing voice, again, the tinny, crappy singing voice. Right. That was probably my last profanity, by the way, talking about the doll.
Crappy's a lot.
The crappy singing voice coming out of the tiny plastic doll. They've recorded it with their iPhone model year whatever, and they've uploaded onto internets. And here's Emma Watson's singing voice debuting to the world through this chain of events.
That's the new way that these things are going to get released in the future. Yeah, we're dropping our single in a doll.
And I look at that and go, well, there it is. It's out. It's out in the world. And the fans are all, you know, to use a scuba diving metaphor, what you'll find when you guys inevitably take up scuba diving is you'll find that...
That's happening, like, next week, actually.
Absolutely, yeah. Just in time for summer. When you guys take up scuba diving...
We both got our beach bodies ready, so...
When you go underwater, when you're at depth, if you bring in one of your pouches or pockets a bag of frozen peas, and you open that bag of frozen peas underwater, you will be surrounded by 1,000 fish within about 2 seconds. Fish... They see that green ball, and they know what it is, and they're all about it. So when you wake up in the morning, go on Instagram, it's like there's Emma Watson's singing voice coming out of a little piece of plastic, and the fans are swarming, because here it is. And I, without even thinking, just repost it to my Instagram and go, well, there it is.
Oh, boy.
And then... It doesn't turn into anything negative with the studio, which is great. There, I have folks I've been working with there, but the texts start right away. It's like, this is up, this is online, what are we going to do about it? And then here's the horrifying thing I have to say, is then 3 hours from now, you start to notice that you're picking up followers.
Mm.
And it's happened to me enough to know, for me to know that something is the matter, and you start to look around and you're like, oh my God, my name is like in Forbes or Entertainment Weekly or Vanity Fair, because Beauty and the Beast co-producer Jack Morrissey has verified.
Oh.
And you're just like, but that's social media.
Right.
You repost the thing without even thinking about it.
And now it's your imprimatur.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
It's not, but it's ultimately been, I think it's ultimately been a huge positive. I think, frankly, I think it's been a positive for the studio ultimately, because I'm the guy who's on the front lines reading a lot of this stuff and sometimes telling them stuff that's breaking before they're aware that it's breaking. Because obviously any studio, let alone the Walt Disney Company, which is also happens to own theme parks, et cetera, is a huge global presence. The information, of course, all of these large multinational companies do have, you know, spiders, if you will, that crawl the internet 24 hours a day, looking for mentions of the company's
It's how George Lucas always gets the Star Wars holiday special taken off of YouTube. You know,
is he still pursuing that?
I think whenever it goes up, it comes down. Like, wow. That's a constant.
But the studio is like a nuclear powered aircraft carrier. You can't just tell it we need to turn right now. Right. It takes them 10 miles to turn.
Right.
It's just the size of things.
Yeah.
You know. So to have someone who's paying attention to the internet, or who has fan site operators, because I got very close very quickly with three or four of them who are operating 24/7 out of their own obsession, who are then telling me, oh, by the way, this has just been posted over here. It just means that everything can move faster, you know?
Have you ever had any interest in...
No.
Okay. Because you are, I think, in a lot of ways, sort of sitting on a gold mine of marketing information about, especially I'd say about like a particular demographic. I think I'm sure there's a lot of carryover.
I should have let you finish your question.
No, but you know exactly what I'm going to say. Like you know, has anybody approached you to say like, hey, we're marketing this movie to, you know, 14 to 23 year old women, and we could really use your, you know, acumen in this? Because you've pretty much always just done it for Bill's films, period.
Yes.
But in doing so, I think you've probably accrued stuff that somebody would want.
Yeah. Certainly with that demographic, And not a bad moment to interject. Obviously, we've had a very, 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 very good weekend at the box office.
Yes.
Here and around the world. The best thing that I heard from him last night, and Bill is so, I mean, you guys know him, he's not
hyperbolic
around in it. He doesn't really. At other moments, when people think like, God, you guys must be so happy, or God, you guys must be, or, you know, it's like, no, he's a good version of Bill, and there's no real bad version. There's no screaming or throwing at furniture. He's not the Beast, you know, but a good version is when things are going so well that he is asleep. He's napping. That's
he can calm version. Down.
He doesn't really derive a lot of pleasure from the conventional trappings of what other people would perceive as a success with a movie or something.
Yeah, right.
Your the gold swimming pool notwithstanding.
What's that?
I said your gold swimming pool notwithstanding.
Yeah, exactly. Our gold spittoons. The best thing that I heard last night from him as we were talking about, you know, obviously you now are on the inside of a machine where grosses are being reported from around the world and then domestic, and how are we doing on the East Coast, and how are the East Coast so-called late nights? Mm. Are the late nights strong? This is a family film, but it's also kind of performing like a Star Wars movie or a superhero movie might perform in a way.
What's your Friday to Saturday and your Saturday to Sunday? Yeah. And
the best thing that he said, it sort of didn't hit me until I was repeating it to, again, my aforementioned friend Dawn. This morning, the best thing that he said is the idea that with a strong opening in March that is affecting other historic strong openings, in this very real case of Batman versus Superman, which is the previous title holder for biggest opening in March, the fact that a movie like Beauty and the Beast, yes, a movie musical, but a movie musical that, and a movie that really appeals to little girls of all ages, to women, gets to come up into that rarefied air of what many would perceive as more boy-driven movies.
Sure.
Is just so cool. The fact that, you know, again, this sounds a little log-rolling, obviously, but the fact that he doesn't take it to a place of like, oh, well, my own personal success. Finally, I myself, Bill Condon, have a movie that for him it's about women. I think it's just so cool. No, I admire him.
It's always exciting when that happens. And what always, the joke I always say
and
is,
the last time it did was Twilight.
Oh, yeah? Okay.
And not really since.
True.
In terms of these, we're only talking now about these grosses. Obviously, Fifty Shades of Grey, incredibly successful.
Course.
But in terms of big, you know, $500, $600, $700, $800, $900 movie grosses.
Yeah.
Or the Hunger Games, some might argue.
Sure, yeah.
But even those skew a little more boy friendly, right?
The thing I always say is that that for studios, like, that men get to fail a bunch,
yes,
but that when women's movies, when women targeted films do well, it's always a fluke.
Yes.
And then once one does badly, then it's your excuse to not do one for a while.
And I have to say again, I feel like I probably said this on this podcast before, but the interesting thing is when you are on the inside of, or, you know, you are welcomed to be on the inside of something like the Twilight phenomenon, which we were, you get inside, you meet the women, many of whom are, they just defy any dismissive, derisive take that you might have on them. They're not dumb, lonely heart hillbillies who live in Hogs Hollow. You know, they're educated women, they're mothers, they're business women, they're professional. Some of them have to keep their fandom in the closet. Some of them fly that flag proudly. When you're on the inside of that phenomenon and you see the numbers, you see the global box office numbers, you get your framed gold album representing sales of your soundtrack.
Right.
You see how many books Stephanie Meyer has sold. You see how many books E.L. James has sold. What you don't see is really anybody, any of the guys who are at these movie studios and production companies coming after it, trying to knock it off in the way that they try to knock off every comic book success, every space opera success, because at the end of the day, even as they look over there at the success that Summit, now Lionsgate, had with the Twilight Saga movies and those unbelievable, it's billions of dollars. Mm-hmm. It's billions and billions of dollars when you get into
licenses,
VOD, merchandise, licensing, all that stuff. And no one has really tried to imitate it.
Yeah,
you get a few here. It's like Beautiful Creatures at Warner Brothers.
Right.
A few attempts, but not really, because it doesn't interest these guys.
It doesn't interest them. It's always a fluke. Always.
Yeah.
And if it's same for like black films and queer films and whatever else, if one breaks through, that was just a random thing. And let's go back to like men blowing up the world. You know, this is the movie.
I will say the joke is, you do read a lot of tweets after the success of Moonlight, which goes all the way and crosses the finish line of finish lines, right? Mm-hmm. Best Picture at the Academy Awards. And you do read a lot of tweets going back and forth that are variations on, you get out there and you make your $17,000 movie and never give up on your dreams. You go make that movie because look at what happened to Moonlight, and that can happen to you. It can happen to anybody. And there is a part of you that reads that stuff and goes like, oh my God, those programmers at Sundance or those programmers at the Hermosa Beach Film Festival that are now going to be inundated with...
Well, you know, look, I was
the micro-budget movies made by folks who really.
But that always happens. When I was a film festival.
But when was the last time a movie of this scale has gone all the way?
Well,
fueling those hoop dreams.
Well,
you know what I mean?
To the Oscars, no, but in other ways. I mean, I was a film festival programmer in Dallas from 95 to 99.
Yep. USA Film Festival, right?
Exactly. So I got every Pulp Fiction knockoff imaginable.
I can't.
Then I'm sure after I left that job, whoever had it next had to watch every My Big Fat Greek Wedding knockoff imaginable.
But but the point I'm making is, every Big Fat Greek Wedding knockoff still requires a cast of, let's say, 20, because if you can't have a wedding without a cast of 20.
Right.
Every Pulp Fiction knockoff requires a few cars
and
a few guns.
Oh, I see.
Every Moonlight knockoff requires three actors and an iPhone. You know what I mean?
True.
Which is not to discourage anybody, but where is the, back in the early 90s, I knew this legendary illustrator quite well, Greg Hildebrandt, who with his twin brother Tim sort of made their bones with these illustrated Tolkien calendars before even the first animated Lord of the Rings movie, or as they called it, Rank and Bass, they referred to as Rank and Bass Hobbit, animated Hobbit TV special was made. Then they went on to paint the very, very famous commercial Spencer Gifts version of Tom Young's Star Wars painted poster. Anyway, so I knew Greg Hildebrandt very, very well. And this guy can't write a personal check, without exaggeration. Cannot, where do I sign my name? Cannot write a personal check, but is one of the great, great illustrators of all time, in my opinion. And you would say to him, or you would have conversations that were something along the lines of, God, what's it like for you to like walk into an art school or an art class, and they all just, again, all the fish must just rush you as soon as they see your bag of frozen peas. And what do you say to people? You know, they're all putting their work in front of you. And his thing was, and Greg has no ego. He's completely childlike. He has no ego. So there's no judgment in what I'm about to repeat. But Greg said, yeah, I mean, you know, you can look at somebody's work. You can tell immediately whether or not they're ever going to be able to make a living paying rent and putting food in their mouth through illustration. It's not about whether or not they're great or gifted. It's like, do they have what it takes to be paid to make a living off this? Even a modest living, right? Mm-hmm. You know immediately. And, well, you never tell them. You never discourage them, ever. Right. Even if clearly what they've shown you is a stick figure, you know, with a little embellishment. It's an embellished stick figure. You never discourage. So I don't mean to discourage.
Sure, no, I hear you.
But Moonlight, again, when you, the breathtaking success of how small that is.
Yeah.
But the thing that, but the talent.
Yes.
And that's the thing. It's like.
That's a hard.
Yeah,
that's
get your friends together and make a small movie. Who is talented?
Yeah.
Now, who is to say who is to talented? I ask of two critics, right? That's a rough road.
Well, you don't know until you do it. That's the thing. You know?
Yeah.
You might be sitting on something that's really great and a story that needs to be told and an interesting way of telling it, but until you do it, you'll never know.
But even after you do it, depending on your level of delusion that helps you to put your feet on the floor and drag your carcass out of bed in the morning, you may still not have any sense.
Oh, believe me, I earlier mentioned that filmmaker talks about, you know, Wong Kar-wai and Claire Denis. Their movies do not get the Oscar traction that Moonlight got, or the public conversation outside of like rarefied cineast circles in this country.
They're famous among subscribers to Film Comment.
Exactly.
Yeah. So that's it.
Yeah.
And New they're York famous Film on this Society. Podcast.
Well, certainly.
Because they're the greatest. Just FYI.
So we have one letter for this episode.
We have a letter. Yeah. It's from Rachel.
Oh, I...
It's for you, Jack.
Yeah, I know her. I'm picturing her face right now.
Dearest David Alonso, it warmed my heart to hear that my very favorite guest, the highly controversial Jack Morrissey.
Oh, my Lanta. I told you I saw Moonlight, and I loved it.
Okay, good.
Would be... You are only controversial on this show. And you are only controversial in that for a brief moment in the history of this show, your appearances received equal amounts of hate mail.
I know.
As when Manola Dargis would show up. But now Manola has turned into the darling of the show, of the guests.
Well, why wouldn't she?
People constantly, whenever she's on, people are like, oh, I just love her.
Have her on again.
But they don't do that for you.
Of course not.
No, you get requested, though, quite a bit.
But that's the other thing. Just as many people will email us and say, I think it's great when he comes on. So you remain number one in both
hate
camps.
Mail.
Yeah, you are hot.
No, I'm not number one. What you
directions.
Just said, don't walk it back. No. What you just said is Manola is number one.
No, Manola
in the love column.
Manola went from a balance to like it's now it's all good. You remain
I'm
the
number
balance.
One in the loathe column.
You are yin and yang. Is what
because
we're trying
literally,
that's what I was trying to get across.
But
there.
Let's. Yeah. Take it all the way. Take the river to its head, because of remarks made about 12 years a slave.
Was
right?
that what it was?
That was yeah. part of it, but I think there might have been some other stuff too. I don't remember
really?
Now. I have to go back. The 12 years a slave thing did come up, but I
no.
Think
I just think it's plain speaking, and I'm in. Even then, I was in DGAF mode. Now I'm really in DGAF mode, and so as not to make more work for Alonzo, I would just encourage anyone listening to Google DGAF at the Urban Dictionary, and you'll see.
That's right.
That
I was thinking
for
it was
don't give a frack to
okay.
use the Battlestar Galactica.
I thought you meant
parlance.
DE-GAFFE.
No, DGAF.
But, okay.
Okay.
Don't give a frack.
So here's
gotcha.
The. Here's
care.
The rest of the letter.
She's not done.
Oh, no.
Rachel,
no.
Come on.
She loves you.
Oh, my
land. Warmed her heart to hear that you were coming back on the show.
Uh-huh.
In fact, it was Jack's on indefinite hiatus, Team Jack podcast.
I know.
That
yeah.
introduced me to you, gentlemen.
That's reduced her?
No, introduced us.
Okay.
Introduced me.
Like, she found us thanks to you and
yeah.
us going
well, you
on your
were
show.
On.
Yeah. And I have been a faithful Linoleum Knife listener ever since. For me, your shows are inextricably linked. David Alonzo, please do your best to convince...
Inextricably or inexplicably?
inextricably. David Alonzo, please do your best to convince Mr. Morrissey to get back in the podcasting saddle.
I know.
Yeah, what? Yolen's not going
to
have anything
else to do, right? As you
gentlemen
have been
he
so faithful for
Greg
so long.
Greg Yolen lives with his wife and daughter in Brooklyn now.
Ah, curses.
And Bill Condon, at the moment, lives in Los Angeles. Which complicates things because we tend to record that podcast, the Team Jack podcast, which if I wasn't already so far down the road with however many episodes of that, I would probably change the title. But we record that in the living room
right.
at our place, and Bill Condon, no Reiki to come home from lunch at Jones on 3rd to find... interlopers in the castle.
Well, you may just have to start doing out calls then.
Yeah, maybe so.
Take your massage table out to other
maybe
people's
houses. So. She's still not done.
No, there's more. So now that Beauty and the Beast is in theaters, it is a smashing success. What is next for you, Jack and Bill Condon?
Bill Condon,
I heard
what's next is already announced.
About a stage production of A Star is Born.
That's right.
Where when that be happening? Do you have any other passion projects for your team? I enjoy Bill's movies so much and look forward to seeing more in the future.
Rachel. Did she sign her last name? It starts with V, right?
Yes.
Yep, I know exactly who she is.
Yeah.
So yeah, tell us about this Star is Born.
Star is Born starts with... This is good. Like, this thrills me because, A, I think I can provide a little more information than currently exists in the online sphere about this project.
For the
and
teaser.
B, it's too early for me to get in trouble for providing any information about it. Star is Born is, like Beauty and the Beast, begins with an incoming phone call from Warner Brothers Theatrical Division, which I think is probably just straightforward Warner Theatrical, and they have decided internally that they would like to develop a Broadway version, a theatrical version of the Judy Garland Star is Born, not to be confused with the in-production iteration directed by and starring Bradley Cooper opposite his leading lady, Lady Gaga, which will be the 1, 2, 3, 4th cinematic iteration of A Star is Born with the Streisand Kris Kristofferson version from the late 1970s, maybe 77 or 78, right?
76.
I'm literally thinking of flipping through record albums in the soundtrack section at the PX on the military base I was living on, having to flip through however many Star is Born LPs to get to Star Wars. And then Frederick March and Janet Gaynor.
Right.
Did the first.
Yes.
Right.
Which and then if you really want to drag it in there, the first one was sort of a semi remake of a previous film that George Cukor, who directed the Judy Garland version, had also done called What Price Hollywood.
Okay.
But they weren't musicals until the Garland version in 1954.
Okay.
So I assume the stage version is not going to have Evergreen in it then.
So what I would say is Bill has already... So it starts as an incoming call. Bill immediately sparks to that idea. Mm-hmm. He feels that it's an interesting... The Hollywood of it all is an interesting potential fit for him as a movie director who would be going back to a theatrical space after Sideshow, which also, as we know, had its cinematic connectors with the presence literally of Todd Browning near the end of that musical as he gets ready to make his movie Freaks, starring the Hilton sisters.
Mm-hmm.
He's very excited. And so Warner Theatrical has their desired result. They immediately start the conversations. The conversations are, I wouldn't call them advanced now, but obviously he's signed on. He has announced. They have had creative meetings. I do think that much like Beauty and the Beast or Mr. Holmes or Twilight, Gods and Monsters, what any fan of any version of any iteration of Star is Born can expect is that he will dive deep. He will look at any and all iterations that have previously existed. He will study them and he will draw from them, as I expect they're probably all owned by Warner Brothers. And so they can all be drawn from in some way, but clearly this is meant to be a theatrical staging of the Harold Arlen musical,
right?
Which is an obsession.
Ira Gershwin, right?
Yeah,
yeah,
I think so.
Oh, I love that movie, and there's that amazing
The Man That Got Away, right?
Yes, but there's that great Ronald Haber book about the making and then restoration of the film, which is must reading for folks. If you've never seen the 1954 Star Is Born, by all means see it, and then also get the Ronald Haber book, because it is one of the best sort of production histories I've ever read.
Right.
And then the lengthy process of how this movie was butchered by Jack Warner and then decades later pieced back together is a fascinating story.
Right.
And I am dying to see what Mr. C has to do with all this.
Yeah, it's sort of like, again, much like Beauty and the Beast or Breaking Dawn, it will ultimately be his version of it that pleases him.
Mm-hmm.
So folks who might want to know, why is that song from the Broadway version of Disney's Beauty and the Beast not appear in the movie? Why is there a new song instead? Or why did you omit that scene from the novel Breaking Dawn instead of it? It will only ever just be Bill's version, but he will really break his back doing the unbelievable due diligence on it, and he will he lives, eats, breathes, drinks, work, and he really does sweat it. He wants to do the best version of, in his opinion, of course, and based on his taste and choices, his best version of anything that he comes into that is a pre-existing property, let alone a pre-existing beloved property. And then he hopes that other folks feel good about it.
Right.
But it's his choice. These are his choices.
Do we know where this is? Like, is it going to be like La Jolla?
No, so I think, that's interesting because, Sideshow started down at La Jolla Playhouse in an initial staging that was a co-production with the Kennedy Center.
Mm-hmm.
So it initially goes up at La Jolla and then goes out to the Kennedy Center. And then based on the reviews out of La Jolla, but then principally out of the Kennedy Center iteration of Sideshow, they get to come in, as the saying goes, they get to come into Broadway at the St. James Theater, right? Mm-hmm. The experience with La Jolla Playhouse and connected and separately the Kennedy Center were both phenomenal. I don't know. I have no idea what Warner Theatrical is thinking in terms of what they want or need. Obviously, if you can mount a production like this out of town, again, as the language goes,
right,
at a place that does carry a certain weight and prestige, like La Jolla Playhouse, let alone the Kennedy Center, then that's a good look on you,
mm-hmm,
as opposed to, you know, I don't know, the Duluth Playhouse or something. I don't even know that there is such a place. But, you know, why wouldn't you want to be at Paper Mill in New Jersey,
sure,
or La Jolla versus
there's certain,
an esoteric,
certain theaters
esoteric
that are known
theater
as launching pads for Broadway,
yes,
productions. Like,
yeah,
I think, I know Seattle has kind of become that,
yes,
in a way, like for Hairspray,
yeah,
and some other stuff.
Yeah. So I think I haven't heard, and as you've plied me with intense coffee, I would tell you, it's like, I haven't heard anything like that.
Gotcha.
Nor have I heard any casting. I've heard, I mean, obviously the idea with this show, not dissimilar from Dreamgirls, from the movie version of Dreamgirls, is, or obviously the stage version of Dreamgirls, you have to, in the creation of something that itself is about an act of creation, you have, it's really nice if you can create a star, right?
Oh, sure, yeah.
Jennifer Hudson, Jennifer Holliday,
yeah,
in the Broadway version of, or obviously the Broadway classic. So you're not going to exactly get nobody from Carbondale, Illinois, mm-hmm, to come in, and you're not going to create her necessarily. You are going to have someone who's already spent some time on the boards, as it were, but I haven't really heard any, I haven't heard, really heard any names yet. It will be a, it will be a woman,
and there will be new songs, I assume, because there's kind of a handful. I mean, there's,
I think so, yeah.
Man, They Got Away, and
yeah,
You Gotta Have Me Go With You, and
yeah,
and you know, there's like four or five. But I mean, for a Broadway show, you'd really have to, you know,
yeah,
like I'd imagine that like Norman Maine needs to have a number now, and there needs,
right,
to maybe be like a big closing song, like there's, you know,
yeah, and some
like
a little dirt I can give you is he is starting to sort of think about and therefore talk about having to find and meet and talk with and then ultimately bring aboard someone who can write the book, the script,
right?
But depending on everything that goes on now that Beauty and the Beast is finally in the world, out in the world, in terms of a next movie or anything like that, he may start working on that book himself.
Okay.
And just start writing on it himself. He's written on every single movie, regardless of whether or not he's received screenwriting credit or sought screenwriting credit.
Right.
He's written somewhat or greatly on every movie that he's made since Gods and Monsters.
Mm-hmm. That he won an Oscar for.
Yeah. Well, yes. He's not going to write on something, right?
Of
he
course.
Wrote a lot on Beauty, yeah, and the Beast. He wrote on Twilight.
Mm-hmm.
So, and he does not do well with idle hands. There's no, in 20 years, there's literally in 20 years, probably not dissimilar from you two fellas, I expect, in 20 years, there's never been a beach vacation ever. Never laid on a beach. Never been on a vacation.
Wow.
Never to Hawaii. Never to any place tropical. Always the idea, the word vacation literally is never used. I'll tell you what's immediately next is
just conk him on the head.
I'll do the impersonation. What's next is and then after Japan, because they have to go to Japan for one last
premiere,
right? Japan always tends to open just a little after the States. Yeah, so after Japan, I'm going to I'll go back to New York, and you know, I got tickets for one last extravagance. I got tickets for
Hamilton?
No.
Oh, I don't know. You're pointing at me like I know. I don't know.
Hello, Dolly.
Oh, of course. Right. Naturally. I forgot. That's a thing that's happening right now.
How much were they? I don't want to. No, how much were they? Come on. I don't want to. Is it thousands? No, it's hundreds. It's hundreds. But it's like, it's the Hamilton right now. It's an impossible ticket. But I have to go. I have to go. And it's like, why are you asking permission? It's like, of course you're going to go see Hello, Dolly.
You get to write it off.
The answer to the what's next question is Japan and then Hello, Dolly.
And one night and then back to work.
Yeah.
We're not opposed to vacation.
And then back to work. Yeah, then back to work.
Yeah, we're not a...
Do you guys vacation?
With his family.
Yeah.
Where?
They have a house in Maine. We'll go visit
where?
Them.
Booth Bay Harbor.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. But no, on our own steam and dime, very
You get
rarely.
There, they've got lobster waiting for you. His family's the best.
That's pretty great.
Yeah, it is.
And Parker House Rolls.
Were there?
Or whatever maybe, they call them in Maine now. The thing that's at every restaurant here in Los Angeles, served always in a cast iron skillet with salted butter, et cetera.
Yeah.
You say lobster, I see lobster roll.
Well, yeah.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Me you too. Say lobster, I picture buttered bread.
That's me too.
Right?
And well,
and that slop falling out of the sides, falling off the sides of it onto your paper plate.
Or you're not doing it right.
Yeah.
Jack Morrissey, it is always a delight to have you here.
Anytime.
Where can people find you online again?
Oy. Facebook. So Facebook and Instagram. Facebook owns Instagram. So on Facebook at one point in time, I had to, you know, there was that moment on Facebook where if you wanted to, you could actually pick up a so-called vanity URL so that you wouldn't, when you gave people your Facebook profile, it wouldn't be facebook.com/674-2358 So
right.
Jack Morrissey at that time was had already been taken, and without even thinking, it's so dopey, but without even thinking, I end up with, instead of that Jack Morrissey, as Dan Stevens has done,
right,
which would have been eminently more clever, I just go, the real Jack Morrissey. Come on. It's so lame. It's like MySpace lame. But so then on Instagram, I do likewise. So on Instagram, it's the real Jack Morrissey.
Right.
On Facebook, it's the real Jack Morrissey. On Twitter, it's Jack_Morrissey. Mm. The Team Jack podcasts of Whence We Spoke are available on iTunes. And you can follow Team Jack. I think it's Team. It's either Team Jack or Team_Jack. And there's a website, teamjack.com, that I think also links to the podcasts that has these great illustrated episode guides that I think Sasha and Kathleen did. Folks like to hear their names when I go on.
No, those are some fun podcasts. Those are some fun breakdowns.
They are fun. That honestly makes me want to make more podcasts. More illustrated episode guides, because I like looking through those probably more than anybody else does.
Well, if that's what it takes to get you back on the stick, get on it. Great to have you here. Congratulations on
Thanks.
The massive success.
Go see Beauty and the Beast.
Yes.
Dave White and Alonzo Duralde wholeheartedly endorse, if not officially, for the rap.
I'm going to tell you, I had a really good time.
I had a blast
watching this movie. I loved being alone in the theater, although again, that's not great for your box office.
I could feel
The Grove is too loud. Maybe y'all
is
should
that
check,
so?
Y'all should check into that.
Maybe it's less loud when there's people in the seats.
Yeah.
Maybe
they absorb. I could tell Mr. Condon's total glee in staging the crazy Busby Berkeley-ness of Be Our
Guest. Yeah, for sure.
Like there's a real love of musicals in that moment, and I mean throughout.
Well,
but
and that's interesting. Let's see whether they get into that on the Blu-ray and DVD.
But
you can break that number down. And literally, I've heard on numerous occasions he and his choreographer, who also did Sideshow, Anthony Von Last, talk about, will there ever be anybody who goes through that number, that musical number, Be Our Guest, and lists out all of the references to choreography from other movies.
Oh wow.
Other musical numbers,
that's
other
a YouTube
stage production
waiting to happen.
Because there's stuff in there that those guys have planted. Talk about coded. They've planted that right in there. You can see Cabaret and Singing in the Rain are the most obvious to the undereducated eye, let's just say.
I also approve, although I will not spoil it, of the last thing Belle says to the Beast.
Oh, yeah. Do you know the story behind that?
The final line of the movie from her.
Yeah.
I like it, and I agree.
Interesting story about that, and I'll probably... I won't get it 100% correct, but I believe if you read... this is like... It's a bad prescription. I don't know how to find the correct version of this. Actually, there's a woman named Stephanie Bertone. If she listens to this, she runs Beauty and the Beast movie news online, which is incredible, an incredible resource. But someone gave an interview. It was probably Don Hahn, who produced the 1991 animated classic and was a producer on Bill's new iteration. It was either Don Hahn or Kirk Wise, Gary Truesdale, one of the two directors of the 91. That last line of Bell's in Bill's movie was suggested back in 1990 for that movie, or they regretted not putting a line like that in. And what's That's interesting, funny. Again, like dovetailing with Disney history and all that kind of stuff, I don't know that Bill knew that. He may have come to that quite through his own process. I don't know that the last line of Bell's in this movie is making a historical reference or not writing a wrong, as it were, but doing something that those guys couldn't or didn't do in 1990. But I know I've heard... one of those three principals, Don Hahn, Kirk Wise, or Gary Truesdale, refer to, I don't think it was Alan Menken, it was definitely one of these three guys, refer to the desire to have that line.
Funny.
And not having done it. Maybe they never tried, or they tried and it came out in market testing or something like that, but they wanted it. And somehow or other, maybe the spirit of Howard Ashman, somehow or other, I really need to ask him when I... like later today, just so I...
The ghost of Howard Ashman?
No, yes, exactly.
Does he live at your house?
I'll ask Bill how and why that came to be the last line in this movie, but definitely it is...
There's a story there.
Innocently or purposefully, there's an Easter egg connection here between this movie and the 1991. It's interesting. Funny. That last line of Bell's.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I'm into it.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. So, yes, Beauty and the Beast now showing ghost thing everywhere.
Not Japan yet, and not France. France, believe it or not, where the whole story started in 1720. I knew her once. Opens in like 3 days.
All right, coolio. We are, as always, thank you, Blue, for our theme music. Go find his stuff at blutopia.com, BLEUTOPIA. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at LinoleumCast. Subscribe to the show for free at iTunes. Leave us a nice review there if you have the chance. We would really appreciate it.
Be our guest to leave us 5 stars.
It's true that we're no Prince Charmings. go to patreon.com/linoleumknife if you want to subscribe to this show. We have tons more programs that only our subscribers get, like LKTV, Linoleum Knife and Fork, our food podcast, and Linoleum Nights, as well as shirts and mugs and bags and other prizes. March. Yes, great stuff.
Linoleum Nights is actually, that was from Aladdin, right?
it was cut early in the
run. You could sing it to that melody.
Right.
So, Jack, it's always great to have you back. We'll have you
on. See you soon, I hope.
Yes, let's do it again, because this is always fun. And until next time.
You said coolio?
Sorry.
Which is so dumb. Goodbye.